like to convene the Finance Committee. We don't have a quorum present yet, but what we'll do is begin with our overview of the state agencies and then take up the two bills on the agenda after a quorum is present. But in the interest of time, want to make sure we get started with the overview then. So, if I didn't surprise you?
No.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
And you were here last week as well, so thank you for being prepared on two different occasions, but we ran out of time. So, as soon as you're ready, why don't we begin with your overview of the state agencies then?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff. You should have a packet of information in your materials entitled Overview of State Government Finance for today. Turning to the second page of the handout, I have a list just of the different accounts that are covered in the State Government Finance Committee. The State Government Finance Division appropriates funding for and oversees the operations of several state agencies and boards, and that includes the legislature and constitutional offices, most of the major state, sort of what we call staff state agencies, that's Department of Administration, Finance, Employee Relations, the Department of Revenue, the Office of Enterprise Technology, and the State Investment Board, among others. The committee also has oversight over the various gambling boards. That includes the Gambling Control Board and the Racing Commission. These two entities are supported by fees. They are not general fund supported, and also the state lottery. And finally, the division has oversight over the various pension systems and does appropriate a portion of the local or the state aids that go to local pension. The State Government Committee appropriates money for the Minnesota State Retirement System. That's basically for the state legislators and constitutional officers that are in the defined benefit plan. It probably does not include most of you at the table, but it may include some of you. Also, the Minneapolis Employment Retirement Fund, and then the aid that goes to the First and Last City Teachers Funds and TRA. That includes the funding that was transferred from the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Association to TRA. And I should also note, I have TERA on this list. The committee does hear those pension bills that have fiscal impact and has general oversight over pensions, but the aid for PERA is actually carried in the tax bill, so there's a little bit of overlap between the two committees. And finally, just at the bottom of this, I want to note real quickly, since some of the divisions have changed, that the Department of Veterans Affairs is no longer in the state government division. It is in the separate Agriculture and Veterans Affairs division. And then some other smaller agencies and commissions, the Amateur Sports Commission, the CAP board just got moved back into state government finance, but the Black Minnesotan Council, Asian Pacific Council, Indian Affairs Council, and Chicano Latino Affairs Council are in the Minnesota Heritage Finance Committee. And I should finally note, public broadcasting is also in Heritage Finance, which has caused a little confusion since the funds for public broadcasting are appropriated through the Department of Administration, but just to clarify. I did not make a copy of the pie that you've seen with the other presentations that show what the slice of the pie that goes to this division is, because you've seen it several times. I'll just tell you, it's a very small slice of the pie, about 1.8% of the state's total general fund spending. But that said, even though it's a small slice of the general fund pie, the agencies that are funded through this division have an impact on all of the operations of state government. They provide the basic infrastructure for state agency operations. And on the third page, I just listed some of those. I won't go through all of them, but for example, the Department of Revenue collects the tax revenues that fund state agency operations. The governor...
I just want to officially convene the meeting. We'll take care of the minutes and so on later, but just so we're officially convened, now we do have a quorum present. Ms. Roberts?
Just some other examples, Department of Employee Relations negotiates state labor contracts and oversees the state employee insurance program. Department of Administration is what we often think of as the state's landlord. They also manage these states. They oversee state contracting and purchasing. So I just wanted to kind of make the point that even though it's a small slice of the general fund pie, these operations are pretty important to all agencies and will, in fact, impact the budgets of the agencies that are funded by other divisions. And then finally, I also want to make the point that the State Government Finance Division, despite its name, does not fund all of the state employees and bureaucracy. And while that may seem somewhat obvious, it has been a little bit of a point of confusion because of some, for example, in the past, there has been a state salary supplement that was appropriated through the State Government Finance Division. So sometimes people have gotten the idea that this division is funding all state employees and things like that, but that's not quite true. Next, I'm going to go to two pie charts that show a view of the division's appropriations, first from the looking at only the general fund, and then going on to the all funds overview, just to show you a comparison of how the view of this division's appropriations change when you look at the all funds view. If you start, look at the first pie again, the state government finance base appropriations are about 1.8% of the total general fund appropriations for the state. And you'll see that some of the large executive branch agencies make up about 54% of this general fund. Revenue is, Department of Revenue is the largest appropriation for this division. The legislature itself, you'll note, is 20% of the division appropriations. But if you move to the second pie and look at the all funds overview of about $1.3 billion in direct, open, and statutory appropriations, the pie division changes a little bit. And I should stop and note that I had to make a decision about what to include in the all funds pie. It does not include the state employee insurance program funds, the trust funds that are funded through employer and employee contributions for premiums, and I also didn't include the pension trust funds because you basically have a pie with two slices. And also most of those funds are not used for agency operations. But the point I want to make here is all of a sudden if you look on the right side, you'll see that the Office of Enterprise Technology, which was only 1% of the general fund spending, all of a sudden moves up to 13%. And the reason for this is that agency has the Enterprise Technology Service Fund, Internal Service Fund, which provides computing services and telecommunication services to state agencies. So it makes a major difference. And again, administration moves from 6% to 19%. And this, again, is because they have internal service funds that provide services to all state agencies, whether it's real estate management or the office supply connection. All of those things are off budget in terms of the general fund, but all of those operations are funded through charges to the state agencies that are funded in other divisions. For example, for the Office of Enterprise Technology, the Department of Human Services is their largest customer of computing services. And then moving on to the brief spreadsheet, this is a look just at the base level for general fund expenditures, and then, although I know you asked us to focus mostly on the base, I did include the governor's recommendations for this division just to show you that where some of that money has been allocated in the governor's budget. The governor's budget includes about $112 million in recommended increases in funding for this division, and by far the majority of this funding is within the Office of Enterprise Technology, and then also within the Department of Revenue for technology projects. The Department of Revenue also includes a major initiative for tax compliance, which I think members will be familiar with. This is something the legislature has been looking at since, I believe, the 2002 session has provided additional funding to the Department of Revenue with the intent of them hiring auditors to bring in additional revenue for the state. And then finally, I'm on my last piece. I included a spreadsheet from the Department of Finance, which provides an overview of all of the governor's IT requests in his budget. And I included this because when the Commissioner of Finance was here a couple of weeks ago, I know there were some questions about with how much funding was in the budget for technology, and was that all included in the state government finance division or not? You can see that about $77 million of the $212 million is included directly in the agencies in the state government finance division. But I think, and I think Representative Kimes can talk to this, that you should be aware that all of those projects that are not within the state government division still have to be, there's still oversight authority from the Office of Enterprise Technology. They have to review the project before it's included in the governor's budget, and then if the legislature decides to approve these projects, there's ongoing oversight authority from that agency, and so they're heavily involved in any IT project, even if it's funded in an agency under the oversight of another division. And that's all I have.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Are there any questions of Ms. Roberts before we turn to Representative Kahn to give an overview of some of the issues that she may see coming before the division? Representative Kahn?
There are two. Obviously, the whole issue of technology and technology control and technology advancement is going to be a very big issue for the division. The other direction I would like the division to move in, other than just the oversight of the budgets, is what can we do to make state government a model for the next century? And there are two general issues I'd like to look at. A model for employment, of which one of the, you know, and then a model for environmentally, environmental construction of buildings. And it's, you know, the two places that we may look to for models for the first one, the employment model that we've heard a lot about, is one that's come out from Best Buy about a work from anywhere in the world area, and the issue on green buildings. One of the people who've taken a lead on best buildings has been Walmart. So it's you know, I think that the state ought to be ahead of both of those entities, but we're going to look and see in what directions the state could move ahead on those issues. Plus, seriously looking to make sure that our technology is going in the right direction. I think those are the three things, or the two things, whichever you want to do it, that I would like to have the division emphasize, other than just the oversight of the budgets that we have.
Okay. Are there any questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Roberts, and we're going to, as I announced a moment ago, we do have a quorum present, and so we have the minutes from our previous meeting. Representative Kahn, have you studied those?
Yes.
Representative Kahn so moves. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. We'll now take up then House File 87 by Representative Powell. And as I mentioned at our previous meeting when we had our first bill before us, we intend to take testimony in the divisions, but we will take questions, and so Representative Powell does have a witness should there be questions here today, but we won't be taking general testimony. With that, Representative Houseman is not here. I'm on the Capital Investment Committee, so the chair moves the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. Representative Powell, if you'd care to...
Thank you. Thank you.
Bill, and then we'll take a motion through... I'll move it now. The chair moves that House File 87 be recommended to pass and put on the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a pretty simple bill. Last year, the Culture Center received $400,000 for pre-design and design work. But because we forgot to put the word pre-design on it, they cannot have access to this pot of money that they already received. So we're coming back to put the word pre-design in it. I want to address, there was some concern that this bill might be used as a vehicle for other bonding proposals. I I want to commit to the committee that that's not going to be the case. I commit to everyone that I will not accept any amendments from either side, and there won't be any conference committee as well. The bill, as you see it in there, will be the bill that will pass all the way through. So, thank you.
Yeah, are there any questions of Representative Tao?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tao, I just was looking at the bill, and I had to read it a couple of times, and you said what we're doing, but are you saying if the bill says design but excludes pre-design, pre-design is not part of designing a building?
Representative Tao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, as far as I understand the bill, without the word pre-design, they do not have access to the money to do the design, pre-design work. That's a technical piece that I'm not aware of.
Interesting, Mr. Chair and Representative Howell, as I read it, I thought, what does this bill need to be changed for? Because it says for design of da-da-da-da. Well, maybe somebody else has got a better answer, but I'm surprised that design doesn't include pre-design.
Okay, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, to try to answer the question a little bit, I think the problem is with bond counsel, be able to, when they look at that, they say that you can't spend it on pre-design if the law doesn't allow you to do that. So that I think the problem is not with us, but with the bond counsel in New York, that they sell the bonds. That's my understanding.
And I might just mention, years ago we had an issue with a research greenhouse, not a small greenhouse like you might see, that we had to make a similar correction because it didn't include the pre-design apparently, and so we had to do that. So that's something that the Capital Investment Committee hopefully will be aware of as the bills go through, that they have to be clear on that. Representative Kahn?
One of the things I would also like us to do is I would like us to look at these kind of assumptions in capital investment and bonding and see if we could do something in state law to fix these up. I'll point out some things that make absolutely... Well, one of the things that I think some of us would like to see is we would like to see some of the increases in technology being able to be done by bonding instead of just by appropriations. And, I'm quite sure that the Constitution didn't prohibit this somehow, that telecommunications could not be covered by bonding. There's some kind of anomalies in the whole situation. When you're building a building, you're starting to build a new building, and you're furnishing it, all of the furniture can be covered, the furnishings can be covered by that initial bonding, but if you're going to do some acquisition of furniture afterwards, you can't cover it by bonding, and I guess I don't understand what the difference between the first furniture and the second furniture is. And I think the issue, I wonder if a statutory statement that design includes pre-design would help and some of these things. I think we have to find out what can we do, because our State Department of Finance has said has put these restrictions on, or what can we do because bond counsel somewhere has said that that's what you need in general bonds. So it requires looking at what's done in other bonding jurisdictions and so forth. For example, I do believe that schools do bond for technology and so forth.
You're making that as a comment or
just
posing
a
question,
right,
to somebody?
Just a comment. It's something that we need to look at. Capital Investment Committee needs to look at it, or the Finance Committee needs to look at it.
Is here, and I assume heard those comments, so yeah. Okay, very good. Any further discussion on the bill, Representative Filthy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that what Representative Westrom was getting at was not really answered. I wonder if staff could let us know exactly what is the distinction between pre-design and design, because I don't think that's just intuitively obvious.
I think Representative Tao indicated he wanted to answer that.
Yeah.
Representative Tao?
I was Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the definition here, if you want to, I'll read it. Pre-design means the stage in the development of a project during which the purpose, scope, cost, and schedule of the complete project are defined and instructions to design professionals are produced. Now for design means the stage in the development of a project during which schematic design development and contract documents are produced. So as we move forward, the Culture Center needs the pre-design stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Robert Mulcahy, and we have Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tao. I'm not on the Capital Investment Committee, nor was I last year, but I do have a question. Wasn't the Hams Brewery site approved for use by the APCC? And if that's the case, it's not directly related to your bill, but to the project, wouldn't that change the project cost, which I think was $9 million in the original bonding bill? So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that cost would change. And also, under that bill, the state portion would be half, and you would have to get the money from private sources. And I'm wondering if you could touch a little bit about what your progress has been on getting additional private funding.
Representative Cowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin. With the pre-design money, I think we'll come to a more concrete number. Right now, there's maybe Ms. Chu will be able to answer on the number that's been floating around and the fundraising activities.
Ms. Chu, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
Naomi Chu. Actually, when we put in our request for bonding last year, it was actually for a site on University Avenue. When our bonding request switched from bonding to planning dollars, we weren't able to exercise the option on that site. And so that's when we sort of started working in partnership with the city and identified the HAM site, which we did just receive HRA approval on. Whether we were at the old site or whether we were at this site, we're still in the pre-design phase and need to move into design. And the preliminary cost estimates on our portion of developing the HAM site are still being finalized, but I would say that they're in the ballpark of about, and I hate to put out a number, because it could change in 2 weeks. So, you know, it's more than $9 million, and it's in the ballpark of more like $16, $18 million. And the way that our fundraising plan is comprised is about 50% private, corporate, foundation, and individual. And then we will be putting in a request for 2008 bonding, as well as looking for federal support and city funding, city and county. But it's not, you know, I don't know how to say it.
Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Chu, I guess my concern is this is actually a little bit bigger, the actual project, not the specific bill, than originally anticipated. And so my concern is that it go back to the proper process. But could you comment a little bit on, you touched on it a little bit, but maybe put a monetary figure behind the non-state funding you've been able to raise thus far?
I think that's directed to you, Ms. Chu.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, at this point we have commitments of almost $1 million, but last on site, what we've done is laid the foundation and laid all the seeds with the foundation, but we cannot go back and solicit them for funds until now, until this year, because we lack official site control. What we anticipate is to be able to raise about $7 million.
Representative Mahoney? Did you pass? Representative Mahoney? Oh, okay. Any other discussion? Then the chair renews the motion that House File 87 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Ms. Chu. And we'll now go to House File 293. Is Representative Wagenius here? Is there somebody from that division that's here that could move the division report? Representative Wagenius' division. Motion is before us to adopt the division report. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Tingelstad, I don't know if you were here when I mentioned, being that the testimony was taken in division, the intent would be to have you then present the bill and to have LCCMR staff available for any questions that may come up. Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have before us here House File 293, which is a compilation of all these papers up here and months of work and hundreds of hours by a team of 17 members of the new Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. It reflects a $23 million package, most of which comes from the Lottery Proceeds Environmental Trust Fund. And I know you have several things in your packets that will probably answer a lot of the questions that you may have about who is on the LCCMR as far as the makeup. This year is the first time we have citizens, and we felt it was very successful process, very encompassing, and we feel that we have a good package here. And information about what's in the budget book related to the LCCMR, as well as the actual projects that were approved. There were over 80 projects that were submitted, and this $23 million package reflects the ones that made it through the process, about 32 projects. And a big emphasis this year on water protection, land protection. Your last two sheets in your packet show the information about proposals received and then the actual recommendations from the commission. Mr. Chair, members, today I have with me John Boleyn, who is the director of the LCCMR, as well as other staff members who are available for questions. I understand there might be some discussion about tax or revenue issues with Representative Lencheski, Representative Solberg. And I want to make note at this point, too, that Chair Carlson, Representative Carlson has served on the LCCMR. I appreciate his hard work. A lot of the meetings were held during the holiday time of year last fall. And Representative Lauren Solberg had chaired the task force that worked about a year ago to put together the change from the LCMR to the LCCMR with the seven citizen members who are now involved. And one big piece of the changeover is that we will be submitting a bill on an annual basis instead of every other year. We feel that that's a faster way to get projects going out in the environment. And I see that Representative Wagenius is here, too, played a key role and on the LCCMR. And I guess with that, we're open for questions, and I think there may be some discussion here when Representative Lencheski brings
briefing. We'll be making a motion shortly. Representative Wagenius, you had stepped out. We adopted the division report. Representative Hackbarth moved that. But we haven't made the next motion yet because they're talking between the tax committee chair and others as to whether it will need to go to taxes or not. So we'll take questions first, and then we'll make a motion pending the outcome of their discussion. I think they're working on an amendment, so it doesn't need to go to taxes. So are there questions, Representative Swigum?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Swigum, in relationship to the projects and who will be getting the grants, the work for the projects, there was a legislative auditor study here not too long ago that was somewhat critical of the state and the grants we give out in relationship to competitiveness, the openness of the grants. And I see where most of the grants here are going to the University of Minnesota or Mankato State or some public entity, but if you would look on page 13, and I don't know what Rural Advantage is, 13.98, the projects involved there, or even in the next page, 14.3, where it is mentioned with some Boonstro Ripening and Electrum Associates. In both those cases, give us some comfort in relationship to the auditor's study, why we would designate somebody for the grant as opposed to having it a competitive process.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Valine, the director for the LCCMR. The LCCMR process was actually addressed by the auditor and noted as exemplary because it is so competitive and because of the oversight that we provide. The critiques in the audit report, and I'm not going to try to represent the auditor, but my reading of the audit report and discussion indicated that the problem with naming specific entities, none other than state entities, in legislation, the problem was that often there's been no particular competition to get that particular project to that particular entity. Under the LCCMR process, we have a broad request for proposals. As Representative Finkelstead mentioned, we received way more proposals than could possibly be funded. Those were vetted and vetted and vetted, and finally the commission members decided on a particular package. So to that point about competitiveness, I'm satisfied, and I believe the auditor is satisfied, that our process is very, very competitive. Secondly, on the other part, which is the nature of the entity to whom it goes and the oversight, this entire amount of money, when it's unless it's appropriated to a state agency or the university, will be done using the terms for an agreement with. And that means that there will be a contract with that particular entity, in this case Rural Advantage or Bonus Grow Associates. That contract will be made with a state agency. We will operate the contracts on a deliverables basis. They will be reimbursed for deliverables achieved if, but only if, the deliverable is achieved, or a partial deliverable in some cases might be achieved. So it's done on a reimbursement basis. There will be desk audits and periodic field audits on the individual projects, both for performance in terms of evaluating the product, as well as for looking at the specifics of the financial transaction. And I believe I will get some concurrence, I believe, from Auditor Nobles, that this is an exemplary process and will be even more exemplary in the future.
I happen to serve on the Legislative Audit Commission, and that question did come up there, and I would just confirm what my understanding was as well when I asked that question the auditor, what Mr. Valine just happened to comment. Representative Swingham, you have
a
follow-up?
Just follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chairman. I certainly agree that the nature of the LCMR grants are very, very competitive. 87 grants, is that, Kathy, I think. I was interested in two of them. We did not make the list of 32. So I know it was very, very competitive from the applications for the money from the Environmental Trust Fund. I understand that. That does not speak to the competitiveness, though, of the specific grant, such as on page, let's go to the one for pyrolysis, is that what it is?
Pyrolysis.
Pyrolysis, a pilot project. That does not speak to the specific nature of the competitiveness with the University of Minnesota in cooperation there for Rural Advantage or for any other, I don't know who Rural Advantage is. I have no idea who they are. Or if there's any other entity out there that could compete and do the same thing. But you spoke, I think, to the competitiveness of the grant. Fully understand, that does not speak to the competitiveness of the cooperation of the university on this pilot study.
Mr. Chair,
Valine,
and members, that is true. The commission recommended this particular project because they thought it was a very important thing to do and they thought it would be very well done. It is true that we didn't take the project concept, this specific project concept, and run a statewide RFP on that specific concept. We are of the opinion, based on the testimony and my understanding and talking personally with the project manager, that nobody else is doing this.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons, that's literally, that
and
describes...
I don't know that.
Yeah.
Could be true or not true. I don't know that.
Right. We could pull those out and say, this is an ideal thing to do. Let's make sure there's competition in doing it. But I've found in a number of cases over the years that, in fact, nobody else is doing it. And so there wouldn't be any other bidders, if you would. I suspect we could go through that particular process, but I don't know how the temperament of the 17 members, if they'd really want to go that much longer, because it would involve a very much a two-step process, first selecting the ideas and then getting specific competition on the ideas.
Mr. Chairman, just to finish your follow-up, I don't know if there are other groups that would do that same type of service that Rural Advantage is going to do or not. I have no idea. Maybe they might be the sole provider of that service, and if that's the case, you can charge whatever you want for the baseball site, I guess. On the next page, line 14, so page 14, line 2 and 3, where with the Board of Water Resources, Bornestro, Russin, and Anderlecht, and the first, I assume that they are consultants of some way, shape, or form. I assume that there are other architect consultants that could do the same work as this group does. Maybe it's getting too nitpicky, but yeah. We just came off this legislative auditor study, and we should be sensitive to it.
Mr. Chair and members, Bonister, Rossi, and Anderlecht and Associates is a private sector firm that does planning, architecture, and engineering. I suspect that, yes, there are other planning, architecture, and or engineering companies that could do similar work. We didn't receive any proposals from them. It was kind of a unique idea.
So the Board of Water Resources worked only with Bonestro, or did they...
Mr. Chair... Mr. Chair, remember...
They're great people. They're wonderful folks.
The Board of Water and Soil Resources literally had almost nothing to do with had zero to do with the selection of this project. It was the LCCMR members who selected this project from among a wide range.
That I understand.
We assigned the Board of Water and Soil Resources as the state agency to be a pass-through fiscal agent to implement and monitor and pay on that particular contract. So Bowser had nothing to do with the selection. It's only the LCCMR, but they are doing a favor. I think it's part of their, they feel a sense of their responsibility as a state agency to be a fiscal agent to a certain extent. Once the extent gets larger, then my philosophy has been in the past that if the trust fund creates a general fund burden because of implementing trust fund projects, that we have to make sure that the trust fund pays for the impact that it created. And so what we've done in the past, and there's actually a small amount in here for DNR, we've actually provided money to DNR in one instance to actually do the contract administration and administer the pass-through contracts and do the fiscal processing in order to not create a negative effect on the general fund budget. In this particular case, because Bowser only has two or three of these projects, they said they didn't feel like, I talked with the deputy director there, he said he didn't feel that that small number is going to have any significant, maybe even not a measurable impact, such that we could have an arm's length relationship on a contract.
Chairman, just an opinion. If Representative Singer said is satisfied with this arrangement, then the chair is satisfied. I am. When we got that study, I just become a little sensitive to when we specify any program or any group that is not state-oriented or University of Minnesota in statute. I just, it's wasting your time. I just thought we should be concerned about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Singer, I appreciate those questions because obviously... We like to see the scrutiny. I think the LCCMR, the LCMR staff has done a great job through the years in making sure that projects are scrutinized, and we're always open to public scrutiny. So I'm glad to see that your questions are being answered. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius moves that House File 293 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. There are still more questions, but I want to get it before us. And Representative Solberg will have an amendment that resolves the question about whether or not it would go to the Tax Committee. So maybe to get the bill properly before us, before we revert back to questions, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, I think a handwritten amendment is being passed out, and I would move this handwritten amendment that's given to us. And it deals with page 3, if you remember, line 24, so, and 25. And what it deals with is the Forest Legacy Conservation Easements. And these easements on 24 and 25 require that it must be have a sustainable forestry practice management plan. There is in state law a sustainable forestry incentive plan. And there's a, when you use the word sustainable, it becomes confusing whether or not that's a tax issue or a planning issue. And under the law, if you have a sustainable Forestry Incentive Act plan, it cannot be enrolled in something else. It can only be enrolled in that. So to be able to clarify that, the staff has come up with this amendment, and let me read it so that it's on the record. Page 3, line 26, after the period, insert, land subject to easements acquired under this appropriation may not be enrolled in the Sustainable Forest Management Incentive Program. And I think that clarifies that the use of the word then, sustainable, and that there's a different words, different meaning for that same word.
Representative Solberg moves the amendment, and Representative Lincheski wanted to have Mr. Michael comment on
yes.
the amendment. So,
thank you.
Mr. Michael.
And Mr. Chair,
to further clarify, Representative Chesney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while Mr. Michael is joining us at the table, I do want to clarify for some of the members who've been following Representative Tingleton's bill as to whether or not it should go to taxes, because there are many people who've raised the issue in this committee for various reasons. This amendment addresses the concern the Department of Revenue raised as it relates to the tax credit, and Mr. Michael can talk about that. Similarly, Representative Wagenius and Representative Carlson and I, Chair Carlson, have had another set of conversations with Representative Tingleton as it relates to the property tax burden for putting land in conservation easements that's contained in this bill. And I think we've had some good conversation to work out how we might want to address that going forward. And so I think all the issues now that are floating out there as to whether or not this bill needs to go to the Tax Committee have been addressed with this amendment, but I think Mr. Michael could also address the component that relates to the conservation easement, and there's an income tax issue federally, but for the state's purpose, there is the property tax component as it relates to taking land off the property taxes. So if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I think it'd be appropriate for Mr. Michael to address both this amendment and those other set of tax issues that are hanging out there so we can all get the right information.
Okay, Mr. Michael.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Representative Solberg described the effect of the amendment correctly. Essentially, there's a separate tax credit or incentive program that's operated by the Department of Revenue that's called the Sustainable Forest Management Incentive Program that entitles landowners that enroll in that program to annual incentive payments. What this language does is to make it clear that if conservation easement is purchased under the appropriation in the bill, that the landowner cannot therefore also enroll in that incentive program. When larger landowners enroll in that incentive program, they're required by law to make their land available for use by the public. And some landowners may have chosen not to enroll in that program precisely because they do not want to make their land available to the public. essentially what this would prevent is if they then participate in this forest legacy program and essentially sell the right to the state and are required therefore to make it open, that would eliminate the barrier that they would perceive to participating in the forest legacy incentive program. And so then it would almost make sense for them to decide to enroll in that program and get the annual payment. So in effect, this prevents sort of double dipping. To just talk briefly about the two points that Representative Lincheski made, there is in present law a mandate for assessors to reduce property tax values for lands that are subject to conservation easements. The tax committee in a bill that just passed last week eliminated that mandate to make it permissive because there are some instances where assessors have told the committee that they believe that these easements have little measurable effect on the value because they sort of the highest and best use of the property is sort of consistent with the easement, and so the assessors, given the nature of the easements, don't feel that they really reduce the value in a way that they can put a number on. And so that tax committee provision addresses that concern. As Representative Lincheski also mentioned, there are income tax implications for conservation easements. Those implications occur when there's a donation of an easement because the landowner can qualify for a charitable contribution under both the federal and state income tax. Under a program like this where the state is actually buying an easement, that usually wouldn't come up, but it's possible that you could enter arrangements where the state would pay less than 100 cents on the dollar for an easement and the balance would be a donation, and the federal law, which Minnesota follows, allows that. But that would sort of be up to the managers of this program if they can negotiate that, which actually would be a good deal for the state because we'd be paying less than the full value of the easement. And then the donation element would provide a tax benefit to the landowner. Most of that tax benefit would come from the federal treasury, not from the state treasury, so that's why it would be a good deal for the state. But that's just background information on these types of arrangements. If there are any questions, I can try to answer them.
Okay, Erickson Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, that's unfortunate about the eliminating that law. A few years ago, I noticed that that they were required to give a break on the taxes for the easements. And the problem I was having in my district is the assessors see those easements as huntable or leasable or recreational, and they're just jacking up the taxes to be heck on those things. And so I wanted some teeth into it, actually, to turn it the other way around, because the assessors, I think, are taking advantage and assessing it too high. Not everybody wants to lease it for hunting. Not everybody, you know, has great potential for sales, but it's disincentivizing the idea of putting land into these programs. They're going to keep jacking the taxes up. So I was wondering what the reasoning behind that was. One kind of works against the other, it seems.
Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I think you may be confusing two different situations. One of the dynamics out in valuing agricultural land, and I'm definitely not the best person to be talking about this, but one of the dynamics is that assessors are finding, as I think you're indicating, that oftentimes the sort of the agricultural value of the land is not its highest use, but rather the recreational use. And so in some instances, that's affecting the values that they put on agricultural lands, and that's this effect where the value goes up quite a bit higher. The change that the tax committee made addresses a law that says if the landowner enters into a conservation easement arrangement, not leasing it to somebody, but, for example, entering an arrangement with, say, the Nature Conservancy or a state agency that says we forever give away the right to develop this land in a way that's inconsistent with the terms of the easement. The law now, as it's written, says the assessor has to reduce the value of that land to reflect the fact that they've transferred this easement. What the assessors are saying is because the terms of those easements are not inconsistent with what they have determined to be the highest and best use of the land, the sale of that easement, say, or the donation of it to the Nature Conservancy, really, in the assessor's judgment, they can't put a number on that to say that it really reduces the value of the land in some limited instances, and so they don't want to be mandated to try to make that change, and so that's the change as recommended by the Department of Revenue that the Tax Committee made. I hope that may be helpful. I'm sure it's not a very good explanation, but that's sort of the best I can do as someone who's not an assessment professional.
Representative Spielberg, I understand you have some language you want to incorporate into your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I wonder if Ms. Novak can read it so we get it in the corporation to clarify it a little bit more.
Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chair and members, after the word program on the handwritten amendment, insert under Minnesota statute, comma, chapter 290C.
Mr. Chairman, I can incorporate that into my amendment.
Okay, very good. Any further discussion on the amendment?
Yes.
Representative Rukavina.
So, Representative Solberg, I was listening to your senator the other day who had some concerns on the Forest Legacy Program in general about whether or not when you purchase this or when there's easement purchased on the property, if certain things like ATVs and that will be allowed in them, and he was concerned about it. So what did you just do when you put under Minnesota Statute 290C there?
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I don't know, but the staff said we should do it. Let me see if I can answer that question.
There's no back.
It's a clarification, I understand.
Clarify Representative Rukavina's question.
Mr. Chairman, and members, Chapter 290C is the Sustainable Forest Resource Management Incentive Program. It's simply adding a statutory reference to what's already in the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I'm assuming here, and I'm looking at this whole language, and I'll have more, Mr. Chair, to say about this bill in general, but right now on this particular amendment, I'm assuming that a lot of this is going to be like potlatch property, being in private forests and large chunks. Now, they're already breaking up the forest by leasing out property, which they used to get a tax break, I think 0.04% maybe, for letting people, the public, use it, but now there's do not trespass signs all over the woods up there, and they're getting about $1,000. They're getting some high price to represent Cornish leases. So I'm concerned, we got a group of legislators and citizens sitting on the LCMR. I don't think any of the citizens have an election certificate, but that's a whole other issue. But it seems now that you're setting public policy. Any easement acquired must have a sustainable forestry practice management plan. I don't know what that is. I don't know if there's these people that are paying big bucks to lease this potlatch property are even going to be able to drive their ATV out there to go deer hunting or whatever.
Mr. Chair, let me try to answer the question as I understand it, Representative Rukavina. My understanding into the sustainable forestry incentive program, that must be open to the public.
For ATVs or cross-country skiing and bird watching.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I think the open to the public, then there's another law that would allow that, the definition, I think, and that law would be the Highway 2 compromise from a couple of years ago, of what would be allowed open to the public. My understanding is that that's as much as I know about it.
Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Wiginius can help me. Representative Wiginius, if this bill goes through and there's $2 million spent and a lot of it's up in northeastern Minnesota and they get easements on potlatch property, are those people that are paying big bucks to lease that property going to be able to drive their ATVs or four-wheel drive trucks or whatever, like they used to get there and then to go hunting and whatever?
Representative McGinnis, are you prepared to answer that? Otherwise, I think Mr. Valene
would be glad to give an attempt here.
Representative McGinnis.
The easements are negotiated, hopefully between DNR and Potlatch. So, now sometimes they're intervening groups that will get options on land, and which has been happening, and get options on land, and then DNR purchases that way. Those negotiations are what Potlatch is willing to do and what DNR is willing to do. We are not setting out those specifications in here. That's just not on the table in this particular bill.
Well,
those are strictly negotiated.
Mr. Chair and members.
It's like a contract, Representative.
Representative Rukovich.
Mr. Chair and members, that makes me very uncomfortable, first of all. You know, I'll get into this later, Representative Greiling, where they're spending a bunch more money to purchase land and giving it to the DNR before they pay the school kids for the land they've already confiscated from them and state parks and scientific and natural areas and everything else, which is a whole other issue. But now you're telling me I have to trust the DNR to make sure that people that are paying, $1,000, $2,000 a year for a lease on a 40 in the middle of the woods where they've always driven their four-wheeler, and I don't really even like four-wheelers, to tell you the truth. I went cross-country skiing twice this weekend. I hate snowmobiles, too. But I still think, you know, that they should be able to use them if they've been using them, and I don't think that that we're going to be given the DNR a lot of authority here, and we don't even know what they're doing. So, Representative Solberg, I'm shocked and dismayed.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wagenius still...
Okay. I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding here. If we're talking, which I think we're talking about, land that belongs to Potlatch, they have all the property rights in that land. We as a state have no property rights in that land. The question here is what part of the bundle of property rights that Potlatch has do we purchase when we purchase an easement? Potlatch does not have to give up any property. It does not want property rights. It does not want to give up. The only way we could assure what you want, Representative Rukovina, I think, is to just outright purchase the land.
Hey, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's two issues here. What I'm trying to do with the amendment is to clarify the word sustainable forestry within this particular amendment, whether or not we like the forest legacy conservation easements is a different issue. But I want to separate that from the sustainable forest incentive program underneath my amendment. It's a clarification. If we would go down the Sustainable Forestry Incentive Act, that requires the openness for the public, and I would think that openness in public is defined as openness in public under other laws that would allow everything else that we allow on public land other places as well. The legacy program, however, when they want a forestry plan, when you use the word sustainable, it became confusing whether that was involved in Chapter 260. My amendment is clarifying that there's a separation of the two. Whether or not like the legacy program is a separate issue than what my amendment is. I don't know if I clarified that or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius, we did discuss this issue in your committee, and I was just talking to Representative Rukovina about this a little earlier. We talked about the issue in committee, but the issue was brought up. I wish somebody from the DNR was here. Is Mr. Meyer here? I don't think so. But we were told in Representative Wagenius' committee that the department was going to look at this issue and try to come up with some language to clarify this. Our problem, folks, is on this forest legacy stuff, the DNR does come up with a contract with the landowner, but doesn't necessarily negotiate whether we're going to have access during the right times of the year when we want to do things like hunting and fishing and those kinds of things to the land. So if we need to come up with some kind of language, if we're going to be giving out this kind of money and
this whole forest legacy issue was sold with the idea that the people of Minnesota were going to have access to the property. So, but when the DNR negotiates these contracts, they don't necessarily give that or even ask that of the landowner, whether that is going to be part of the contract or not. From what I understand, some of these contracts are written in a way that, well, yes, you're going to have access, but we're going to maintain when that access is going to take place, or it's only going to be 6 months out of the year. Well, we need to say, well, they're going to have access during hunting season, for example.
No.
Those kinds of things, that's where we're falling down on this forest legacy issue. Those kinds of things need to be clarified. The DNR is going out there and abiding by the law, but we didn't write the law properly or strict enough or tight enough to say that folks are going to have access during the hunting season or whatever other kind of access that the public might be looking for. So that's the problem that we have right now. Yes, it is landowners' rights, and they have the opportunity to say, no, we're not going to give those kinds of accesses, but it's not even being asked of the landowner. That's the problem.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this debate is really about whether we should be purchasing land outright or giving easements. And in this case, folks have argued to do easements knowing that we were not going to get all of the bundle of rights that Potlatch or any other corporation owns. And I think there's major question whether a company like Potlatch would give up the right to allow ATVs on property. And I think that they're worried about, if I understand correctly, they're worried about the forest regenerating. So we may be asking more of a program than it can give if it is to allow full access of the public. In that case, I think we have to own the whole bundle of rights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, and to the amendment, just for some clarification, if this helps, maybe it makes it more complicated. I think the issue that Representative Cornish and Hackbarth and Rukavina and Representative Wagenius are raising are not about this amendment. And I think this amendment is just clarifying for the Department of Revenue how this language works as it relates to the program that Mr. Michael was talking about, and if we can get that language in the bill doesn't go to taxes. So I think that's the point of that amendment. The other issue that's now being discussed is something that the Tax Committee will be working in, is something that Representative Marquardt's Property Tax Division will begin hearing bills on soon. And so that is something that is not going to leave the purview of the Tax Committee. But I do think that Representative Wagenius and Representative Hackbarth and everyone is raising a good issue and is something for hopefully interim study to really link the tax benefits and the land usage issues that are in Representative Wagenius's committee to really make a decision going forward if the state of Minnesota is getting a good deal buying conservation easements as opposed to fee interest. And so I think Representative Wagenius is arguing here that it's probably not a good deal for the state to spend all this money and then not have the property rights. And that's not being, if I understand correctly, changed in the bill or the amendment. So it's an interesting discussion, but I don't think it's relative to the amendment. And I think it is something Representative Wagenius and I have talked about spending some time with committees working on it going forward.
Yeah, I think that helps. Any further discussion on this Holbert amendment? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now we'll revert back. Representative Kahn, you were on the list a while back. Yes. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, well, I just wanted to emphasize what Mr. Baleen said about when the legislative auditor's report was before the State Government Finance Committee. That question was specifically asked about the LCCMR, formerly LCMR Grants Project. And again, they said the same thing, that was an exemplary project. They had seen no problem with any of the grants in terms of overseeing whether they went to public or private ones. And one of the other additional hurdles that gets put into LCMR grants is what's called a peer review process for anything that uses scientific expertise. which has a special level of oversight that doesn't go into things like acquisition and so forth. The other thing I wanted to point out is the importance of the change in what we're doing with this bill. One of the issues that was criticized about the former LCMR process was the long time between application and actually getting the money on the ground. And one of the points that was made was that one of the reasons that happened was that it was always included as part of the environmental finance bill. You know, if someone was using it as a bargaining chip for something, even though it was hardly ever changed in the course from the original LCMR recommendations till it got enacted into law. And the point was made at that point was that if we just take this work that was done during the summer, usually, and we passed it as soon as possible in the session, my thought was the first week, but I guess that's never possible, you would then get the money out and get it on the ground. And what's particularly important with these projects is that you get it out, we get it out as quickly as we can this month, hopefully. That's a whole growing season that we've added. It's much more than just a couple of weeks or something like that. So we expect to see much more effective use of the money, much more timely use of the money, and the process, besides going to an annual rather than a biennial process, but with retaining some of the advantages of the biennial process, i.e. the carry forward part of it, should help us see much better results from this, from these activities. So, you know, it's a good bill, and we should pass it as fast as we can.
Any further discussion on the bill?
Mike?
I got a lot of questions, Mr. Chair. Representative
Rucavina. Well, first of all, you know, I've been listening this week to all the senators out in Congress backpedal on giving their power up to the president on the war, and I might add that, you know, I may have voted for that citizen committee before I voted against it, but, you know, I'm very concerned about the fact that people without election certificates are given away. No, it's just chump change here on the Capitol, but $22 million is a lot of chump change. And now we got to make in policy because nobody can ask me what the DNR is going to negotiate and the bureaucrats are going to be doing it. You know, Representative Greiling, are you still here? Oh, yeah, you're here. Well, for years I've been talking about what's been done to the kids. Maybe if I got to give a little primer course to the new members on here. But I'll just give you an example. Since 1993, there, well, that's a couple termers. You're close enough. Since 1993, when we changed the flow of Permian University Fund lands, we have two endowments in this state, and just, well, actually, the money didn't start flowing, I think, until 94. So in 12 years, we have two endowments, one that's giving 20% of every incoming freshman at the University of Minnesota $1,000 to $2,000 a year, and the other one for minerals research up at the Coleraine Lab of the NRI. They're both endowed at $37 million already. Now, you have that huge school trust fund that we keep letting the DNR take money out of. Over 60% of their timber sales they take for administrative fees, which is outrageous to begin with. But then they've got all that money locked, or land locked up, Representative Greiling, and state parks and scientific and natural areas, which for years I've said is unconstitutional. And, you know, if you turn to page 6 and 7, I mean, we're spending $1.5 million for buying more land before we pay the kids off. Why don't we buy the land that belongs to our school children, that constitutionally is supposed to raise money for public education, before we run off buying more land? Now, I realize we're only the third largest landowner in the United States of America behind the federal government in Alaska, but maybe before we push to get ahead of Alaska, we should really do what's right and follow through on our constitutional obligation to have those lands raising money for kids. You know, and then, you know, I'm puzzled as to why on page 4 we're giving the federal government money, you know, we're giving money to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service and to the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service, you know, when they got a $3 trillion budget they're proposing, and we're giving them money. To me, members, you know, there's not enough legislative scrutiny in this, and I've just brought up a few issues here, Representative Grinding, but I would hope you would start voting me, because I've been trying to do this for the last 12 years around here. Representative Carlson, when you were chair of K-12 Finance, we had that study done by the legislative auditor, and people just keep ignoring it. They just keep ignoring it, and it's, my frustration is getting to the point where I just can't believe we've got to keep buying more land when we can't, we've got to cheat our kids out of the land they own that's supposed to be raising money for them. So I'm going to vote no on this bill, and I'm going to be ready on the House floor with a number of amendments to pull some of this money out and spend it where it should be spent, and that's buying the school kids' land back from them instead of stealing it from them. I mean, I don't mind stealing money from me dying on that, but not from kids.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just a question.
I'll pronunciation on your name is Ken, so I'm sure to get it right.
It's Garofalo, Mr. Chairman.
Garofalo. Okay. Representative Garofalo.
Just a request of staff. Would it be possible, whether committee members are interested or not, in getting a graph showing the market value of the Natural Resources Trust Fund since its inception? The data we have right now is that it's $455 million. If we could just have a historical graph of that.
Marks, is that Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the Permanent School Fund, the Permanent School Fund Trust Fund?
No, this is the environment.
Resources.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, thanks.
We'll get that information.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holbert.
I have that information. It is in a report, so it's available. It's also the projections out for the next 20 years as well, with some assumptions made. We'll get that to you, all the members, if you want.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Wagenius removes from motion that House File 293 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Cornish, she wanted to make an announcement before we go to Mr. Soderbergh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
The handing of a book out. It's called the Rural Minnesota Journal. It's produced by somebody that's state-funded and probably comes to the committee at the same time, but it's the Center for Rural Policy Development down in St. Peter. And this one is dedicated to educating rural Minnesota children. And it's not biased. It's an unbiased report. There's about seven different experts in there writing on education, rural education funding. It talks about the Minnesota Miracle, all sorts of history. The funding of school. I thought it would go well with that discussion we had the other day on K-12 education. It gets a lot of history that we were talking about there in these actual facts and figures. It doesn't demonize or blame either party. It gives both of them heck equally. And so it's good little short sections that you can fireside reading here. And the next one is due out is due on rural Minnesota health care by the Center for Rural Minnesota. So it's going to be an interesting one, too. Thank you.
Representative Cornish had actually brought the book in earlier and had to leave the other day before he was able to hand it out. So, thank you, Mr. Cornish. There he is, right before us, Mr. Soderbergh. Which committee would you like to do the overview of? The Heritage Finance or Energy Finance? Because we're limited to about 10 minutes. So, or do you have them both together? How would you like to proceed?
Mr. Chairman, I'll yield to your...
Okay, why don't we take the Heritage Finance first then, and that's only because it happens to be listed first on my agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the handout is going to be coming around right now, so...
Okay.
I'm going to turn this on now.
I'd like to turn it here over to Representative Taylor temporarily, then I'll ask the handout.
Mr. Chairman, while that is being handed out, I'll just start. The Minnesota Heritage Finance Division has 12 agency accounts. They range from the Amateur Sports Commission to the Historical Society to Public Broadcasting to the Zoo, Minnesota Zoo, the Science Museum, as well as the minority councils, the Arts Board, and Explore Minnesota Tourism. So it's quite a variety of accounts. Some of these accounts I've worked for with in the past, I should say, are new to me, so I'll try to give you as much information as I can in this brief time, and hopefully you'll find it useful. I'm going to pass by the first couple of charts, the ones you've seen before, that kind of give an idea of how much the division represents with the general fund. It's about 0.3%. So it's not a very large account, but as everyone knows, it's kind of those accounts that make or break Minnesota as far as its quality of life. Okay. Looking at the overall division, I'm working on page 4. It's the overall division chart. This is kind of an interesting division. About 66 or 63 cents on the dollar of these agencies comes from the general fund. Federal funds represent only about 1.6%. So compared to a lot of the other divisions, they have very few federal funds, about average for general fund. Special revenue funds are about 15.6% of the on the dollar. And the gift fund is a very large gift fund for this particular division. That's largely driven, as we go on, you'll see, by the historical society's activities, both relating to their endowment funds as well as their memberships. But you can see on that page that overall, this is the next page shows that the budgets of this and all funds based budget is about $166 million. $105 million of that is general fund money. Almost $26 million is special revenue fund money. Federal funds are only about $2.7 million. And the gift fund is $32 million. As I said before, that's a very large portion of this particular division's budget is a gift fund. Going to the larger chart page, I guess you can see that I'm going to be working off of this page now. As is often the case, the parts are never like the whole, and as you go through the agency, some receive 100% general fund, where others will receive a majority of their funds from the general fund, but from other funds as well. The one thing I do want to note is that these are only the funds that come through the state accounting system. Obviously, the Amateur Sports Commission is a much larger operation than is showing here. I think it's probably most significant with the Science Museum. That's about a $30 to $31 million operation a year. But yet the state support of that is about $750,000 currently. So when you look at these numbers, it'll give you I appreciate there's a lot of happening off the sheet here, but it does give you an idea of what they do. But you can just kind of pass through and see how the various accounts are funded. The next page, Mr. Chairman, shows a general fund share of the accounts. The Historical Society is by far the largest. It's about 44 cents on every dollar of the general fund is this Historical Society. Explore Minnesota Tourism is another one of the larger ones, as is the Arts Board. The zoo, the smaller ones are Public Broadcasting, the Science Museum, and the Minority Councils as a group. The four Minority Councils are about 2.4% of the account. I don't want to get too much into the governor's recommendations, but they have been out for about 3 or 4 weeks now, so I did want to give you a little bit of a sense of what he's recommending for these accounts. Obviously, the decision items will be made at the committee level, but if you look at the chart that's entitled Minnesota Heritage Fund Division Governor's General Fund Recommendation Summary, you can see overall the governor's recommended about 11.1% increase for these accounts. Now, I know that there's been some discussion in other accounts or other divisions that have come forward with a kind of an overview, and I want people, I'll just kind of short-circuit the discussion. There is only one instance in these accounts, that being Explore Minnesota Tourism, where the dollar amounts, even with the governor's recommended changes, are more than what they were prior to the major budget crisis in 2003. So that'll give you a sense. So when you see the numbers here, it'll give you a little bit of perspective that for most of these agencies, they're still going to, if they come to you and you go, well, what? I see where you're getting recommended a 33.3% increase in the case of the Science Museum. Recognize that they're speaking from a perspective where they still will not, even with this increase, if it's fully funded, be where they are funded prior to the major budget crisis. And I just want people to understand that, so if somebody comes to them, they can get a perspective on that. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Soder. Any questions from members? Representative Kahn.
Yes. Madam Chairman and Mr. Soderberg, would you explain what happened with the Humanities Council? Because I know we got rid of it and then brought it back, but I thought it also needed some state funding, and this had to do with our ability to receive federal funds. Could you explain exactly what that situation is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, back in 2003, we did eliminate the state general fund appropriation for the Humanities Commission. It was about $1 million. I think it was $995,000 per year at the time, and it was eliminated. Now, last year, in the K-12 finance bill, there was $400,000 a year appropriated out of the best practices program over in the Department of Education for the Humanities Commission. But that is not ongoing. So going forward, there is, looking at the 08-09 budget, there is no state general fund or other fund basis for the Humanities Commission.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, let me point out a problem I think that we're having with the whole budget, and I think this brings it up. This is the first time I remember, and maybe it's not the first time it's ever occurred, that we don't see, we usually, the couple of things that we don't see in the budget pages that we have before us, and I think that, you know, we ought to rewrite our instructions for the budget so that we see them from the one, we don't see what the agency got last year. If the space fund is not the same as what the last year's appropriation was. And we used to see that so that we saw what they were. But, I mean, this is one that just stuck out because it was nothing, and I know that there was some money there. The other thing is that we're not seeing, and we used to see this, We used to see this all the time, and I think it's a piece of information. I would urge members on all the committees to ask what it is. We're not seeing the agency's requests to the finance division. That's been totally suppressed. And whether we want to pay attention to it or not, it's still a piece of information that I think we need in doing our budgeting. So I'd urge members on all the divisions to always ask any agency that's before you what the agency request was. I think if you ask, they have to tell you, although they're told that they can't. They're not supposed to tell you.
Until you ask.
Yeah, until you ask. So just make sure and ask.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Any further questions?
Madam Chairman? To that point.
Sorry, Representative Clark, yes.
Thank you. Representative Kahn, I have asked my committee, and it's just reiterated that they can't tell us. Can you tell me as a historian here, when did that change that they started not being able to tell us? Because I know in the past that used to be, but do you recall when that might have changed?
That is not true. They must answer a question. The legislator asks them a question, they must answer it. And you tell them they're getting a zero appropriation unless they do. I mean, that's just, but when it stopped being listed, I'm not sure. I think our staff could probably tell us a lot of that. But we used to get a set of columns that not only had the, what they had spent over the past few years, but also what they had requested, how the finance department had cut it down. And so you saw the level at each point. You saw the level from the agency to finance, from finance to the governor, and then the governor's recommendation.
Madam Chair?
Thank you. Yes, one more quick question, Representative Clark, and then we need to move to Harris.
I've actually had cooperation in terms of finding out the budgets back to like 203 because I wanted to look at that whole thing, but what I have not been able to get cooperation on is just what you just suggested, which is the agency feeling free to tell us what their request was to the governor. And I do think it would be helpful if our staff can help figure out when that did change. And what the, you know, what kind of tradition are we building here so that if we want to change it, we can start doing that real consciously.
Well, thank you, Representative Clark.
Sure.
Just one quick one here, because he needs to give his report. Thank you, Representative Kahn.
I would just say that any legislator who tells
agency head that they're getting no appropriation unless that information is forthcoming. We'll find the information forthcoming.
Thank you. Representative Yaris, would you like to give a quick overview of your priorities?
Yeah, I'll be done by 11:30. I'm glad that the governor didn't cut any of the programs, but I hope that we can make up some of the big cuts, like the arts board got cut about 32% back in 2003. I would hope that we'll be able to make up some of these and restore the humanities board commission, and hopefully even start some new things to be funded. I just hope we can do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions, members? If not, I believe we're ready to adjourn. Thank you.